listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, talking about science, policy, activism, and everything that is going on in our world that impacts our personal health and well-being. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk with different experts, advocates, thought leaders, scientists, authors, doctors, and environmental experts all across the board about what is going on in our world to connect the dots between what's going on there, what we can do about it to make a healthier, better world in which all living beings experience well-being. On today's show, we're going to be covering a breaking story with someone that has been on the show before and whom I've known over many years for her incredible activism on many fronts, including fracking, which we've covered extensively on the show, pipeline, Sandy, you know, in the aftermath. I mean, she's just been an incredible activist and organizer. So today's guest will be Jessica Roth. She is the programs manager at Catskill Mountain Keeper, one of the venerable grassroots organizations that helped get the fracking ban here in New York State. And she's also a member of Resist AIM, AIM being the pipeline that is coming, you know, that is being planned or built to go throughout the Northeast region. And we'll be discussing that and its many dangers as well as breaking news on today's show with Jessica. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Jessica.
Thanks a lot, Allison.
Now, first of all, what's in the news this week is Governor Cuomo's decision to halt the progress of the AIM pipeline, also called the Spectra pipeline, till a safety assessment can be done. Can you first of all tell our listeners what AIM stands for and what this pipeline is to begin with, and then we'll talk about why the governor felt it was necessary to call a halt right now.
Sure, thanks a lot. So AIM is the Algonquin Incremental Market Expansion Project because, you know, the influx of these terrible, dangerous infrastructure projects aren't bad enough. They also insultingly name them after things like the Constitution and Native American tribes, both of which have nothing to do with what's going on in the situation, and it's incredibly offensive to use these names for these kinds of projects that are just so dangerous and are always against the will of the communities living nearby. This is an enormous, high pressure, 42-inch frac gas pipeline that comes from the shale fields, the Marcellus shale fields in Pennsylvania, across three counties in New York. It's scheduled to go through Putnam, Rockland, and Westchester County under major power lines where there have been electrical incidents in the past, across two fault lines, and it winds up through at the end of its run through that area, 105 feet from critical structures of Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant. And the critical structures that it winds up near are actually the electrical, the buildings that house electrical systems that help shut down Indian Point in the event of an emergency. So I've said many times during this work that I feel like I live in a Simpsons episode, that whatever the most absurdist answer is to any possible project is like something some person has dreamed up overnight, and then that's what they do. So the idea of putting a high-pressure frac gas pipeline next to a nuclear facility, and not only any nuclear facility, but a nuclear facility that is old and has failed many times. We have there's been seven incidents in the past year of differing things from, you know, releases of toxins and radioactive materials to shutdowns that they didn't know about. And it's hugely problematic. And there's also 40 years of spent fuel rods stored in this facility. And, you know, Indian Point is, depending on where you are in the New York City region, you know, within 40 to 30 miles from where you live. And so that puts us in the blast zone of a nuclear fallout situation and puts 20 million people in risk's way in the event of a problem at Indian Point. So,
you know what I find so interesting, Jessica, is that what you're describing, which has been, you know, known and protested by community members and, you know, those who, you know, the very same kinds of people and groups who helped get the fracking ban in New York State, many people naively think, oh, we got the fracking ban, we're home free, without realizing that these pipelines carrying fracked gas are coming through leveling trees, ruining communities, and in this case, endangering 20 million people. The reason that this has not been on the public radar very much, although I've covered it, and another journalist colleague named Ellen Cantaro, with whom I work, has covered it over the last year or so, is because the major media don't cover it. This actually, the recent mentions of a dangerous leak at this very plant of, you know, radioactive isotopes is really the first wider mention. CBS finally, you know, mentioned this. And the governor's decision is the first time the New York Times has really said anything about it. So if you're listening to this program and you didn't know that this was being planned, and indeed not only planned, but has been, you know, rubber stamped to go through by governmental agencies. You know, it's this is the reason. Don't feel ashamed, but do feel free at this point to pass the word and let others know, because this is, you know, this is a serious and endangering thing were it to go through. Now, let's just take a step back, because the pipeline is also referred to as the Spectra pipeline. And who is and what is Spectra?
Yeah, so Spectra is the company that is building or trying. Well, I guess they are technically in the process of building, but we are not going to let that happen. But Spectra is a Texas-based company that builds pipelines across the country. They have a terrible safety record. There have been incidents all across the country of leaks and explosions that they were unaware of, that they didn't respond to in a timely fashion. I mean, they're telling us with this pipeline that they're going to, you know, the shutdown valve for it is in Texas, where the company is located. And they claim that they can shut it down in 3 minutes, even though there have been incidents of them not knowing about leaks for months in the past. And they built a pipeline in through the West Village that we tried really hard to stop, and we were unsuccessful. It shares a wall, the basement wall, with the brand new Whitney Museum, and is also hugely problematic because this whole build out is really aimed at bringing gas from the Marcellus Shale up through New York with the pretense of serving us and giving us, you know, cheap fuel. But that's not really the end game. The end game is to ship it overseas, get a lot of money for it. In the meantime, do things like build power plants here that can use some of the gas for part of the time, lock us into a system that we have no alternative to get out of. And then once the prices have gone up because they've been selling it overseas where there's a lot higher market for it, come back here and try to sell it back in the U.S. for a lot more money. So the promises of safe, clean, cheap fuel are all complete lies. Surprise, surprise. It's not safe. It's not clean. It's highly dangerous, toxic. It's radioactive. The process to extract it, as we all know, is incredibly dangerous. And like you were mentioning, I mean, that's the irony of this fracking ban. While there's this ongoing influx of infrastructure, is that all of the reasons for which Governor Cuomo and the commissioners of the DEC and of the Department of Health, the DEC being the Department of Environmental Conservation, advocated for and then actually put in place this ban against drilling, all apply to the infrastructure as well, because it's the same product that's being forced through the system. So if you live near a compressor station, which is the infrastructure piece that is used to change the pressure of the gas moving through the pipeline in order to move it through, you know, at places where it either has to go uphill or it has to go from a smaller to a larger or larger to smaller pipelines, you know, to compress gas requires releases of gas. And so that means that all of the gas that's coming out in what they call a blowdown is leaving all the toxins in the community. And each of them is toxic in and of itself, and mixed, they're even worse. And people have incredible health impacts that are devastating, you know, from upper respiratory to neurological to endocrine to fertility issues. I mean, it's really horrible. And so we, you know, the pieces of this puzzle need to be tied together. But as you mentioned, obviously it's not in the corporate interest for those pieces to be known or for the process to be known. And although there are, you know, provisions supposedly for public engagement in these processes, they're really done in a way that is intended to keep the public in the dark and to not have the engagement that's really necessary, because communities don't want these projects, and they're not safe, they're not healthy, they are incredibly destructive. I've watched them, you know, clear cutting trees with these giant machines that look like they belong in the Lorax, and it's just heart wrenching to see. And you know, not only did we witness, while trying to stop an immense amount of clear cutting up on Reynolds Hill as a community up in Peekskill, in the Peekskill area, then we came back a few days later when it was raining, and I could just see all of the water just like flowing off of the, you know, sides of the hills, and just seeing the beginnings of the destruction of the ecosystem, because obviously the anchors that are the trees were all gone.
Oh, that's horrible. That's really, really sad. You know, it's like that old chestnut, you know, first they came for the, you know, the gypsies, and I didn't protest, and then on and on, and when it came for me, I mean, the trees are really, you know, the gypsies in this situation, you know, and I, you know, more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that the environment is not, you know, kind of some decorative add-on going on in the background of our wonderful lives, but really the actual roots and support for all living systems here on Earth, as you point out. Now, also, you mentioned that this is on fault lines. This is going through areas of fault lines. So then, unfortunately, as occurred in Fukushima, this becomes another way for, you know, us to get ecological feedback as we recklessly endanger the environment and human lives and everything. How safe is it for this combination to be traveling over fault lines? Is this a way that Mother Earth could be giving negative feedback later on, in a way that could be very endangering?
Sure. I mean, there's been incidents of fault activity across the country related to, you know, drilling actual, you know, to drills for fracking waste and for construction and things like that. You know, Oklahoma has had tons of earthquakes. Arkansas, there was actually a small earthquake up in Westchester. I think it was about 3 or 4 months ago now. I don't know that it's related. I mean, honestly, this is something we've been saying, is that the construction of this pipeline is incredibly destructive, as well as the actual pipeline. I mean, not we, everyone who is opposed to this has been saying this for many, many years. And it's highly possible that they're connected. Nobody knows for sure. It's actually part of what the governor's, well, the agencies directed by the governor have cited in the letter that you, in the action that you referred to at the top of the show, because we don't know what the effects are, which is, you know, generally for a smart person, that's when you implement the precautionary principle and you say, we don't actually know the full ramifications of what we're doing. Therefore, we are going to only act on the assumption that we're going to do things that are safe. And if we don't know, we don't know that it's safe. So we're not going to do it. But that's never been the, you know, the MO in the oil and gas industry. And that's a big part of the problem. And so it was really interesting in the governor's action yesterday. What he did was he actually directed the State Department of Homeland Security, the State Department of Environmental Conservation, the PSC, which is the Public Service Commission, and the Department of Health to put on independent risk assessments related to this project, which is something that we, all the advocates who have been fighting against this, Resist AIM, SAPE, Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion, Synergy, all the community groups in that area have been asking for this independent risk assessment because of exactly those questions. We just don't know the full ramifications of what's happening. And because of the fact that this is such a crazy idea, you know, Spectra Energy has been saying how they've gone, you know, like above and beyond the call of duty, essentially, in building this, that they've gone beyond federal, you know, restrictive measures, and they've added all these things to how they're building. But the thing is, there are no federal regulations. There's nothing framing how do you build a high-pressure gas pipeline next to a nuclear plant, because it's ludicrous. And nobody has set out rules for it, because nobody's thought of it and nobody's done it, and it hasn't happened anywhere. So, for example, Spectra says, well, we'll put the pipeline deeper to make it safer. Well, how much deeper are they going to make it? They haven't said. They're just making it deeper. And then there's always, you know, the call of national security as a cover for not talking about these things. But in fact, if you look at Google Maps, you can just see the easement that they've chopped the trees down all along, you know, through Westchester. So it's not like people don't know what the route is. But
let me just interject something here.
Yeah.
People don't know what the route is. I mean, that means that any, you know, God forbid, any irrational groups or people or whatever who want to do us harm in this kind of way would also know. So, you know, if this were designed by those parties that we are so terrified of, we would call this, you know, this highly risky combination of factors, you know, north of the major population center, you know, the biggest urban population center of the United States, you know, a potential act of terrorism. I don't want to, you know, raise the flag in a way that people will go and look into this. But, you know, when the shoe's on the other foot, we use that term. And yet here we are kind of, you know, open sesame to this whole combination of risks, you know. You know, one of the things that I think listeners are going to be asking in their mind is, how was this permitted? Who, you know, was anyone in the government? You know, our assumption is that government regulatory agencies, you know, are looking out to make sure that something is safely done, that we are safe. As you point out, there are no regulations whatsoever in place for this combination of negative, you know, factors and the scenarios that could devolve from them. So there's no one kind of, there's no regulations in place. Who is responsible then for saying, yes, this is a good idea and all is well, you know, on the federal level?
Well, just to clarify, there are plenty of regulations and laws in place. There's no regulations that address the very specific incident of building of a high pressure gas pipeline next to a nuclear facility. But this has been in, you know, through the whole government system. So basically the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is FERC, sounds like a really great, you know, protective regulatory federal agency, when in fact it's an independent agency. It doesn't even pay to actually think of it as an agency. It's run by people who have oil and gas company experience. It's majorly a revolving door between the industry and, you know, quote, government. It's funded predominantly through permitting fees that it gains in the process of the application from all of the companies. So a significant portion of its budget is literally coming from oil and gas companies that are seeking to build projects. So no conflict of interest there, right? And then FERC's aim is to get gas to market. It is not to regulate the industry, as its name implies. It is not about making things safe or, you know, end users or community, you know, wishes or any of those things or any of the responsibilities that one might, you know, think the federal government might have. Its goal is, the questions that it asks are about getting the product to market from the company that puts in the request. So once the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission decides that a project is legitimate, there are state permits that need to be approved. And in this case, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission also needs to weigh in. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is much like FERC and is, you know, in and out of nuclear industry folks and really has done an incredibly poor job of anything resembling oversight. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission essentially relied on FERC. And FERC does, within the context of its assessment, an EIS, which is an environmental impact statement, which is allegedly a major environmental study and assessment of the area and the implications and the effects of the building and operations, and is supposed to outline all potential risks to everything from, you know, birds and fish and to people and the area, although it doesn't look at health impact. So people are part of the equation, sort of, but not in any legitimate way. And so FERC makes these approvals. They go through this environmental impact statement. The environmental impact statement is verbatim, pretty much the same thing every time. There may be a few words of change, but it's essentially boilerplate language. It always finds that there will be, you know, minor to moderate environmental impacts. It always says the company can mitigate the impact. FERC, we say, has never met a project it didn't like. We affectionately call it the rubber stamp machine. It literally does not fail to approve projects. They make everything work no matter how it goes. And in the past, when that happened, this pipeline went through the DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, here in New York. It's the New York State Environmental Agency. And the DEC approved both the water quality certificates and the air quality certificate, saying that there was not a significant enough impact on either water or air to stop this project. Obviously, people disagreed with that. There was massive, you know, outrage over it. People were participating in the process. We submitted tons of comments and, you know, and scientific information. And, you know, but essentially, they're fairly limited in the amount of authority that they have. They're very, you know, they're supposed to essentially rely on the federal study that's done first. That's the kind of primary information. And then these, you know, the water quality and the air quality certificates are much, they're a quote hard look at the information, but they don't have the same kind of, you know, framework as like an environmental impact statement does. So, but that said, you know, it's not like they have no power, and the New York State government does have power, and those are actually a tool that they should and they could and should be using to protect New Yorkers and to protect our water and to protect our air, and they didn't do that. And so it's really actually fascinating that Governor Cuomo has done a 180 on this. And what I think is even – I'm still processing this, honestly, because it's such enormous news that this press release came out in this letter that the governor had written. And the thing, one of the things that I find, well, there's many, many things about it that are really interesting. And I don't know if you want me to go into the whole letter now, or if you have another question.
Yeah, let's go into the letter. I think the letter is, yeah, because this is groundbreaking. I mean, it was very both appropriate in, you know, for any normal sense of government for the governor to do this. And yet in our times, it takes tremendous courage, to face up to this and to kind of protect the people rather than rolling over for these powerful companies and the influence they represent. So kudos to Governor Cuomo. And I'd love to hear, you know, your understanding of, you know, what moved him to this common sense and yet in our times heroic protection of the people.
Well, let me back up first. So this letter that came out, as I mentioned before, is a letter that the governor directed to be written from the head, whether it's the commissioner or the chair of the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Department of Health, and the Public Service Commission. And so there's a lot of things going on in here. First of all, the fact that there was an actual action to put out for an independent risk assessment is enormous, because it's what, as I mentioned, advocacy groups and community members and local elected officials have been asking for ages, which is, you know, another thing that's really interesting about the AIM pipeline is that there really has been just massive opposition to it, you know, from individual folks living in the area straight up to all the elected officials. And so it was that much more frustrating that this was approved. But essentially, it seems that there was what the letter cited was seven different failures within the last, you know, year and a half-ish at Indian Point facility as a big part of the focus of why this was happening, which, as I understand it, is the primary sort of concern behind what motivated this. And as we were saying before, when I was talking about the precautionary principle, I mean, if this whole series of things has been happening in the amount of time that they've been building and working on this pipeline, it's only logical to be asking what are the connections between the construction as well and the problems up at Indian Point. And so I think that that was a prime motivator. But the fact of the matter is there's been massive outcry. We are in the process of a direct action campaign against this pipeline. There are also folks that's, you know, run by Resist AIM, which is just a, you know, groups of concerned people who have we've exhausted all of our administrative remedies, and there's something still has to get done. And there's also been direct action taking place against the same company's pipeline for the rest of the route going through Connecticut and Rhode Island and Massachusetts. And you know, people are not happy about this. But the thing that I think is incredibly fascinating about this letter is the four agencies that were put together to write it. Because as you know, Allison, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do as well, people who have been fighting against fracking and against fossil fuel extraction, extreme energy extraction, fossil fuel infrastructure, we all know that there's nothing simple about this problem. You know, people constantly, you know, sort of pin you off in a corner as an environmentalist. And not that there's anything wrong with being an environmentalist, but what I say all the time is, it's not just about that. You know, I consider myself to be a human rights and a civil rights activist and organizer. That's what motivates me personally, is fighting for people's rights. But the issue is that we are talking about the environment. We are talking also about public health. We're talking about safety. We're talking about security. We're talking about the possibility of terrorism, as you mentioned. We're talking about the system that we're locked into to get our energy, that is based on a corporate structure that doesn't serve any of us, that gravely affects people in the way that it's, you know, produced and extracted in communities where there are no alternatives. And it's this full system-wide problem. And so the fact that the governor has put together health, environment, utilities, and homeland security and safety is really fascinating to me, because this has been our message in this movement for like a decade, and it seems like he's getting it, and that this could really be a game changer in how things are looked at and how they're assessed. One of the other things that we always talk about in the movement is cumulative impact, and the fact that everything is always evaluated in this incredibly limited scope in a way to make things never look as bad as they are. Whether it's
Let me just interject here from my science background and my health science background. You know, this comes from the fact that, you know, the kind of fundamental element like of scientific research, and that is in the biochemical area. Obviously, in nuclear radiation, it's a different coin of the realm. But the fundamental, you know, kind of tiniest piece of research is a biochemical interaction of some kind, or, you know, this causes this. These are the, you know, the early science experiments we did as kids, and that's kind of the penny of the dollar, of the, you know, millions of dollars. The smallest item is this one little piece. And because science is new to people, and because, you know, people don't have that much time, and we're in this media landscape, you know, people sell a product or market a product. Oh, hey, this does this. This is true of prescriptive drugs, for example. It does this, and nobody looks at the 20 other things it does. These are called side effects, and they're kind of scurried out of view. So everything has many different effects, but we, you know, in a consumerist culture, this tiny piece of science, and this is why it's called reductive science, you know, is kind of considered the answer. When you're doing anything multifaceted, and that can even be, you know, taking something into a single human body, which has, you know, millions of different functions and interactions going on simultaneously and interactively, and it's even more true on anything going on as complex as what we've been discussing on today's show, you know, that simple reductive thinking does not begin to cover it. It's used as a cover, you know, rather than opening the door to a full examination of what the ramifications are. And that's exactly why the precautionary principle, as you mentioned, is the only way to proceed when you have something very complex with many factors. factors that are, as we've detailed here, endangering. So just wanted to interject that. You know, and what we're saying here is, you know, the Department of Health and others will be looking into this. You know, the entities that have rubber stamped this are under no requirement really to do anything, but as you point out, use this very basic boilerplate language, which really dismisses rather than examines the problem. And it's right. Actually, along with being anti-democratic, it's an endangering, it's anti-scientific as well, you know, in the truest sense.
Right. And in fact, with the DEC, as I understand it, that they're actually not, they're supposed to be not allowed to consider cumulative impacts about different things. So, you know, one of the things that I've testified a number of different times at DEC hearings is the idea that there are separate air and water quality permits, to me, is crazy. Because, I mean, let's go back to, you know, second grade science classes, right? Air and water are the same thing. They're mm-hmm. just different forms, right? They're a feedback loop in the system, right? The water, the precipitation, it turns into, you know, condenses, goes into the atmosphere, gets pressurized again, comes back into the water system. You know, it's a closed loop of a finite resource that those two things are. So the idea that they don't look at those two together to me is insane. Like, if you have contaminated air, you don't have clean water. If you have contaminated water, you don't have clean air. Like, those things are not separate in and of themselves. To put those two as a separate category is one thing, but then to not also look at cumulative impacts of the fact that, you know, we've built this pipeline here and we cut down, you know, for hypothetically, not at all hypothetically, the Constitution pipeline that is also supposed to bring frack gas from Pennsylvania up through New York, which has currently been greenlit as well by FERC, and we're still waiting on the DEC's water quality certificate to come down. But, you know, they've started the clear cutting in Pennsylvania. They're now trying to do the clear cutting in New York State, even prior to having the authority granted to them to do that by New York State's DEC. In that context, they're looking to cut down 700,000 trees in New York. So that is ecosystem destruction. So just even the fact that we're even limited, that the state is limited to looking at just air and water quality permits, is also ludicrous, because the amount of destruction that you're talking about goes so far beyond what you can even pretend to assess in either of those, even if they were comprehensive, which they are not. And they're not being able to look at these cumulative impacts. So the fact that these four agencies have been tasked to do this together really speaks to a bigger understanding, I think, that's really critical right now, because this has been the message for an incredibly long time. You know, we've been working inside and outside of government in all different ways. We've filled all of our obligations. We've written every letter, petition, comment, phone call, all those things, because you have to, you know, like I always say, you have to kind of mark your territory and you have to save your place and you have to say you did the things so that nobody can turn around and tell you, well, you didn't do everything you needed to. I mean, we do those things without the expectation of them actually really leading somewhere, but you have to do it in order to make sure that you have, you know, climbed to the point from which you can jump off. And, you know, and with the AIM pipeline, you know, now we're at the point where direct action has been the only solution. I mean, we're hopeful that the governor will continue to push on this and make sure that these things happen, the independent safety risk analyses. And then, you know, in light of doing the analysis, this letter that was drafted to FERC, and they asked for a stay of, you know, a halt of all construction, which is also really fascinating. That really doesn't happen. That it's part of the systemic problem is that once the juggernaut that is a pipeline build out or any other infrastructure build out moves forward, no matter what else is happening, if there are legal challenges, court cases, you know, other administrative things happening, building continues always. There's not a stay of construction or of action. And so even if there's a challenge and even if somebody wins a challenge, at that point, they kind of throw their hands in the air and go, but it's already built, so here we go. Let's keep going. And it's really a problem.
Jessica, let me just ask something there, because, you know, the very afternoon that the governor, you know, made this decision and announced it and everything, that very afternoon a Peekskill newspaper reported that Spectra basically thumbed their nose at the governor and said, well, we're building anyway.
Of course they did. Yeah, they. Of course. I mean, honestly, no one was surprised by that. I mean, the Spectra response might as well be one of those little kids' toys that you, like, press a button and it just says the same thing over and over again. We have a great safety record. Lies. We've been operating, you know, here safely, no problem, you know, and Entergy, the company that runs the nuclear power plant, will say, we have been operating safely in this neighborhood, in this area for 60 years. Like, well, this letter in particular just cites 7 things in the last year and a half, so we know that's not true.
But I just want to highlight something. There's a difference. I just want to draw a distinction here between, you know, the defensive PR languaging that denies the problem, what you're talking about, and actually saying that despite the governor saying, stop, we need to look into this, they are saying we're not stopping. I mean, that appears to me to be in defiance of the governor.
Well, right. I mean, I was getting to that. I was just going to say that this is like part and parcel of their attitude about everything, which is they do it all right, and they're always going to continue to do it exactly as they have done it, and nothing is going to get in the way. Of course it's in defiance of the governor. They couldn't possibly care less. Constitution also just did the same thing. They wrote in their letter asking again for permission to cut in New York State. They essentially did the same thing, completely thumbed their nose at the authority of New York State, and were like, psh, we don't need you guys. We can keep going. We have everything we need. While we're waiting for you, it's just a formality. And so it's really a problem. And the companies, I mean, obviously, these are companies that have existed since the beginning of their existence with this incredibly entitled both sort of sense of self, you know, if a company could have a sense of self, and the treatment that way from the federal government. So that's part of the problem, you know, is the system that we have set up is that FERC and these companies just do whatever they want to do and keep doing. You know, and from Spectra's perspective, they have all the things that they need. So they're going to keep going because in their, you know, from their perspective and what their lawyers are telling them is that it's all in the bag. So, which is why the fact that this letter was written to FERC, who can stop them, is the critical point. And that's why we say, you know, there's going to have to be continued follow through from the governor as well as all these agencies to make sure that FERC does what the request was. But I do think that even the scope of the request is really a moment in and of itself as well, because this is a huge thing that the governor has asked for, stopping the construction, as I said, because it's really, you know, the gas companies really operate on inertia, and once they start moving, they don't stop. So this would be a really big deal for FERC to actually halt the construction. Plus, he didn't just say to halt the construction. He said, you know, that he's really blowing the system wide open on this. Like the final paragraph of the letter that was drafted says, these ongoing state investigations may reveal newly discovered information related to the environmental health and safety risks posed by siting the project near Indian Point. Such new information may warrant reopening the record on this issue, which could ultimately necessitate a different conclusion by FERC. Until these investigations are complete and the analysis of the safety issues done, the project should not be allowed to proceed. That's huge. I mean, that really, for one, reading between the lines, it really seems to be saying we fully expect that this is going to change. This is going to change the record. This is the game changer here, right? Like this is going to change everything that we know about what's going on. So that's enormous to go back for essentially a second look on this process. Is not done. And you know what you were saying about Spectra thumbing their nose at New York State. FERC. I mean, FERC is like the big dumb. I don't know. I don't want to say even kid or anything, but like the thing in the room, right? That just sucks all the air out of it and takes away everybody else's agency and everything. And FERC just goes ahead and approves all these projects and lets things keep going and illegally segments and looks at sections so that it can isolate impacts and not really look at the big picture ever. Mm-hmm. And this is really like standing up to that for the first time. And it's pretty, It's really significant, honestly. I'm still processing it. We were in the process of, we had a direct action yesterday and shut down operations for an hour and a half at two different entrance sites to a construction site for that Spectra, one of Spectra's contractors uses for building out this pipeline. So we were literally had people in lock boxes blockading the entrances to this ware yard when I found out that the press release was coming down. We'd seen the night before there had been, as a lot of people know, an advance, a leak, something to the New York Times, and there was an article that talked about the governor taking this action, but the actual text of the letter and the press release announcing it didn't come out till about 10 o'clock or so. But we heard about it a couple of hours earlier than that. You know, while we were literally standing, like, waiting for the sun to finish rising as we had these two entrances closed off. And so it was a real sort of confluence of parts of my reality that was very, very strange and very incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I have still not had a chance to, like, fully process this. But from what I can tell about it, it's this is a big deal. It really is. And it's a lot of hard work by a lot of people pushing on a lot of pressure points in a lot of ways over many, many years that that really has come together.
Well, you know, it's fantastic, and I think everyone, you know, everywhere benefits from this breakthrough with FERC in any state, and most particularly the 20, you know, million or so or more people in the New York metro area. This, the work of, you know, these group of dedicated activists, Catskill Mountain Keeper, Stop, you know, the AIM pipeline, Resist AIM, and all of these other groups, you know, really have done an exceptional job when other people, you know, were hoping it was okay and didn't really want to look at it. I mean, I've even written to longtime, you know, friends in the anti-nuke and environmental movement who live in the Westchester area and were just kind of ignoring this, you know. So it takes, it's hard to face up to it. It's hard work to get out there at, you know, early morning hours and do it over and over again to comply in every way so that you've done all of your homework and can't be faulted for that, and then to achieve this kind of victory. And, you know, really, I know you won't be basking because, you know, the work of an advocate never ends. But, you know, I just want to salute you and all the people involved for that. And at the same time, I also want people to be aware of, and I've been covering for a year and a half, these trade deals, which could, you know, if they're passed by Congress, this coming spring is when, you know, they're going to put the push on to do it. It would allow a company like Spectra to get a open a foreign subsidiary and sue the governor and the state itself for, you know, their loss of future profits through blocking something that endangers so much as we've been talking about on the program. And so that's also something, if you're a listener and a concerned, you can support Catskill Mountain Keeper. You can join in, and you can also support Global Trade Watch and write Nancy Pelosi because, you know, and your congressman, because there are going to be key decisions coming up that will either sustain the hard work of activism, you know, or undo it with these global trade deals that I've covered repeatedly on the show. I won't go into them further. Anyone interested can go into the archives and where there are program after program after program about them. Your comments, Jessica?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously true. You know, it sort of goes to what I was saying before about the cumulative impact issue, is that, like, everything is always isolated in the way that we analyze it and look at it. And if we're not looking at the bigger picture and how these pieces fit together, then we're going to wind up paying the price for it. And the global trade deals are obviously just a disaster waiting to happen for many, many, many reasons, not, you know, one of which is the issue of overriding essentially any kind of agency or autonomy by states to make these kinds of decisions. I do want to just also sort of caution, though, that, you know, while this is a huge deal, what the governor has done, and we are, you know, and we're obviously grateful that, you know, that he's on board now, and that this is the direction, hopefully, that the state government is really going in to be you know, thorough and cumulative and interagency in its approach to dealing with these things, you know, it still all remains to be seen, right? There's a lot that has to get implemented for this. The fact of the matter is that this pipeline is under construction, and every day that there is construction that happens, there's more destruction happening in our communities. And, you know, and the system is still broken, or more appropriately, the system is fixed. We have to break it. And so I want to encourage people to still get involved. Like, this is not, whether including on AIM and especially on AIM in this area, you know, this is still an ongoing problem unless or until something changes. That's we continue to operate as if this is the incredible threat that it is on a day-to-day basis. You can check out resistaim.wordpress.com. We also have a pledge to resist if you're interested in direct action. There's lots and lots and lots of ways to get involved. We have trainings on a regular basis in New York and in Westchester counties, in the different counties in Westchester. Sorry, I didn't mean to say just in Westchester County. And there's lots and lots of ways, you know, whether you can get out in those early morning hours, or you want to be in front of a computer, or you're, you know, great at fundraising, or, I mean, there's so many different ways to be involved in direct action campaigns, contrary to sort of popular possible popular belief about it. So there's still a lot to do, and then, you know, and then obviously above and beyond the specifics of AIM, I mean, this is an institutional infrastructural problem that we have, and these things are coming fast and furious, and we need to make sure that the system, we know the system doesn't protect us the way it is, so we need to make sure that something else is. And when it comes down to something else, we talk a lot about that thing. People constantly say, you know, you need to do this, and you should be doing that, and have you done this yet? You know, and the answer is, you know, there's no you. It's all we, you know? If you have an idea, that's great. We want to hear it, and we want to know how you're going to help implement it. We all need to do this together. Yes, you know, this is what we do 24/7, but it's like, it's all of our responsibilities to make sure that we're protected and our communities are safe. The government has proven time and again that that's not necessarily their top priority. So I think that, you know, not to dwell too much on all of the ins and outs of this letter from Governor Cuomo, but there was also a real acknowledgement in it about, you know, the requirements to protect the safety of New Yorkers. And that's an incredibly important point. And something that I think that we all need to learn that little mantra and make sure that we continue to hold our government accountable for doing that, and to make sure that that continues to be the real framework of how things happen. Or starts to be a better framework, I guess, for how things actually happen.
And what you're talking about also is occurring all across New England. I mean, it's happening in other states. There are other organizations fighting this very same pipeline in other locales. Are you in touch with those? I mean, could you briefly mention if listeners are from anywhere else in the New England region where organizing is happening? Speaking of, you know, the interconnection of everything, is there a way, you know, how can people hook up with that if they live in Massachusetts, if they live in Rhode Island? You know, how do they find out and connect with the organizers that are also fighting this on other fronts?
Yeah, FANG is an amazing group, which is fighting against natural gas, and they're organizing in Rhode Island. There are folks who are organizing in West Roxbury. We have all been in touch. We have all worked together. We all support each other's actions, and it's obviously all the pieces of the same puzzle. So there's a confluence of interests. They're building, you know, they're looking to also expand compressor stations in addition to just the pipeline build out. So that's a problem as well. There's Stop the West Roxbury Lateral Pipeline, Resist the Pipeline up there. There's a lot of different organizations that are all fighting. If you go to our Facebook page too at Resist AIM, there's some, you know, links of things that are going on, and there's references to activities of our friends and colleagues. And yeah, you can always get involved. There's a place to get involved on all of these sites, in all of the ways, and plenty of opportunities for that.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. I mean, it's just amazing. And, you know, the world is a better place for people like you and all the people who connect and work with you and in all of these different allied groups. And, you know, it's forming its own kind of network of aware, conscious, committed, and caring people. Obviously, there's fire in activism, in kind of going against what is and facing up to what is harmful. But I have to say, from my personal experience, you know, in the fracking and GMO and on this issue and in all of the in the TPP campaign, that it's you find yourselves among the most caring people in the world and courageous people. You know, the Seneca Lake people who were fighting a gas storage facility in their lake, of, you know, California's against fracking. All across the country, we're seeing people standing up for their homes and communities and for democracy and for the earth and future generations. I mean, even Leonardo DiCaprio spoke about it and used that very language when he accepted his Best Actor Academy Award this past week. So there are a lot of us, and, you know, please join in be involved. I want to thank you, Jessica, for being on the show and for all the outstanding work you're doing. And, you know, a lot of people cheering you on in this moment of victory. And we'll have you back on the show again. You know, when you can take the time from your activities. Thank you for being with us.
Sorry, real quick, I just wanted to say that Resist the West Roxbury Pipeline, I think I might have said stop when I was talking before, which is also a group, but
there are a lot of different groups, and so the correct name is Resist the Roxbury Pipeline,
And just give a shout-out to the folks at Sane Energy Project who have been doing a ton of this work with us in Resist AIM.
And that is Sane, S-A-N-E.
Yep.
Everybody who wants to look it up on the internet, they've been around forever. They're involved in every pipeline issue. They are terrific people. We've had them on the show as well and will again.
Yep.
So thank you to all, and thank you, listeners, for spending another hour with us here on Connect the Dots. If you have questions about any of the things we've discussed on this program, look into the Connect the Dots archives. We have a terrific, you know, backstage of great conversations with great people on a wide variety of topics. Thank you for being with us, and we'll be with you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network for another edition of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.